We are back with yet another commissioned podcast on Bald Move. This is another community commission that several Bald Movers pitched together and pooled their cash and made it happen. This is the 2007 Coen Brothers film, No Country for Old Men, written and directed by the Joel and Ethan Coen. Got a little bit of gold for them. They won Best Picture that year in the Oscars and also Best Director. And went head-to-head with another kind of period piece Western-type feel. Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood went head-to-head and beat him.
Hmm. Okay.
But I a captive bolt right that. Through their forehead.
It's based on a book. Based on a book by an American guy named Cormac McCarthy.
Yep. I've decided I'm going to read at least No Country for Old Men, if not his other one, The Road, because some discussion with the commissioners. By the way, I'm going to shout those people out, the ones that came together and chipped in their hard-earned money to make this happen. You should all be thankful for if you're Coen Brothers fans or No Country for Old Men fans. Keith Alejandro, Jen, Alex M., Matt DeReamer, Stephen, My Dear Deadly, Andy G., Jefferson B., Coco, 2MC, frequent contributor at that mysterious Coco, Gary Turco, Jasmine P, Andrew K, Connor B, Martin K, Joffrey Bowser. Thank you very much. A lot of people came together to make this happen. We have a fair bit of feedback from a lot of those people coming at the tail end of the podcast. Jim, what did you think? Is this the first time you've seen this movie?
No, I'd seen it before.
This is exactly the second time I've seen this movie.
It might be my second time as well.
I remember seeing this movie about 4 years ago. It was a summer evening, and I didn't have anything in particular to do, and I decided I wanted to check out another Coen Brothers film. I watched this movie, and it really knocked me on my ass.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising.
Yeah.
From the Coens, honestly.
And I consider this up with Fargo as, you know, one of their greatest films.
Yeah, I think Fargo's a lot funnier, and that's kind of what I know the Coens for, is their comedy mixed with, you know, they do some dramatic stuff too, but it's more comedy for me.
I don't think this film was devoid of humor.
Not it's entirely,
but very spiced with darkness.
Right, this is no Raising Arizona.
Oh, it's shit, no.
Big Lebowski.
No.
It's not even a Fargo. Like, Fargo's much funnier.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's different for me. It's not really in the same running.
I see what you're saying, but I don't think of the Coens as primarily comedy guys. I can see why you'd think that, but so I feel like it's their best work, maybe undeniably their best visual work. Like, I put the other thing is, I like this as it taps into a Godfatherian place where the performances are so good and the dialogue is so good and the landscapes are so riveting that you will watch, you know, a man stalk a bloody dog for 2 minutes.
And you don't even need music. I mean, there's a grand total of 16 minutes of music in this entire film.
Right. Half of that is a mariachi band trying to wake up Josh Brolin off the sidewalk.
Right, which they didn't even plan on putting in the movie, but Brolin fell asleep, and they're just like,
there
all
you
right,
go. What are you going to do?
Let's do this.
All captured on film. Yeah, you're right. I mean, a lot of people make it a fact that this has a no soundtrack soundtrack, but how effective it is, because, you know, some of the menacing sounds, like the tracker effect, the footsteps on hardwood floors, the they're just as effective at setting the mood as anything. Like, you know, those footsteps and those shadows are Anton Sugar's calling card as much as da-dump is
right.
the calling card of the shark and Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
I think the film is incredible. And
I do too, yeah.
I also have come to appreciate on the second rewatch that this film, the first time you watch it, you think this is the film of Llewellyn, what's his last name?
Llewellyn Moss, yeah.
Llewellyn Moss and, you know, his getting, you know, one up on Anton Sugar.
Right.
And then you come to appreciate, I think that's one of the reasons it knocks you on your ass, is because it completely subverts what you think is going to happen.
It's more the story of Bell,
exactly.
Of the Sheriff Bell.
This is the story of a man coming to grips with his own mortality and his place in the world and the fact that his generation is being passed behind. And And it also, it's not a myopic look. Like, Tommy Lee Jones doesn't necessarily get the last say in it. When he,
right.
I think the one of the key scenes is when he goes visits his uncle, and his uncle is like, this country has always been violent.
Yeah. And it's nothing new, and it's vanity to assume that you can change it.
Right, and that's the thing, like, you know, I think it's interesting that a lot of the violence in this movie stems from the drug trade and the war on same.
Yeah.
And the violence his father, his uncle's talking about was, you know, cowboys and Indian stuff, which was another piece of violence based on large part in, you know, shitty government policies.
Right.
And, you know, like, what are the white men going to stop settling the West? No, of course not. Are people going to stop, you know, wanting drugs and wanting to make money off that? No, of course not. These are just...
Yeah.
Individuals can't do much against the forces that are arrayed against them. But I like that, and the fact that he starts with the narration. There's mm-hmm. a lot of his stuff where, you know, I think that a lot of discussion, the dreams at the end, it makes a lot of sense after you've seen the ballad of Llewellyn Moss. I don't know. It's a great movie. What do you...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that idea of changing times and morality is embedded in deeply in the movie. And there's also, you know, another theme, which I think is fate. And I guess we can talk in more detail about
sure.
both of these. But, like...
Yeah, spoilers for everything, by the way. So,
right.
As always, if you haven't watched the movie, this is definitely one I think everyone should see. This is one of those must-see movies right up there with The Godfather. And I mean, any Oscar-winning film you could say that about. But this one in particular, so yeah, spoilers, go.
Right, so like that morality idea is ultimately, I think, Tommy Lee Jones, Bell, the sheriff, does come to terms with it. You know, he has a couple discussions with I think his father, and then at the end he has the discussion with his wife about his dreams.
The old man in the wheelchair was his uncle.
His uncle, okay.
Yes. Who sheriffed for him underneath his grandfather, who is one of those old timers that didn't carry a gun.
Yeah.
Which shows that Tommy Lee Jones didn't necessarily know what he was talking about when he comes down to the old timers.
Sure. But ultimately, he does come to terms with it at the end with when you consider his dreams, right? He's got these two dreams. The one is kind of very straightforward and shows the beginning of his journey. And the second one is kind of the end of his journey, where he's come to terms with this idea of sort of the inevitability of just the path that the world is going to take, and there's not much you can do to change it or even protect people from it,
right?
From that fate, and from the people who would do harm to them. And then the idea that, you know, it's been like this and it's always going to be like this, and the best you can hope for is a small comfort inside of the larger cold wilderness.
Right.
And I think that's him, his at least subconsciously expressing the idea that he's come to terms with it.
And I think that there's like that, this tale of these two dreams is kind of like a parallel to the movie itself. He talks about the first dream about the money and connect with his father, but that's just like an offhand passing reference. Like, that's not important.
Right.
Then his father going forward in this cold land to make a warm place for him to go to, you know, very much in the vein of, you know, the Christ promising his followers that he's going to heaven to make, you know, prepare rooms for them.
Right.
But
that's telling the audience not to worry about the plot of
the bag of money. No one gives a shit.
Right.
What this thing is about is about fate and about dealing with your own mortality. And I don't know that I agree that Tommy Lee Jones takes a lot of comfort, because the way...
I don't know that he's comforted. I think he just comes to terms with it. Like, he understands that
his
inevitability.
That's a man that really, whatever revelation he got from this dream, he's still really bothered by it.
Right, and it's kind of mixed up in his retiring, too. Like, is he giving up? Is he...
I mean,
is he able to be like the fire that his, you know, grandfather or whatever set out to make in the wilderness? Or is he just going to give up and let the wilderness and the cold kind of take him over.
And I know a lot of people, especially men, they see their retirement as kind of the end of their life. Like, this, sure. I had a purpose. I was preparing to be a man that could provide to people, and now I did provide for people, and now I'm no longer working, I'm not contributing to. And I've never... maybe this is because I'm a lazy beatnik, but I've always been like, man, I can't wait till I can just not have to work. And then that's kind of like when my true life will begin, because now I can really pursue my interests and hobbies and, you know, my education on my own terms, and I don't have to compromise. And I don't understand the guys who are bored in retirement. But I do feel like that maybe, that's the other thing, is like, maybe if I was a quarterback for an NFL team, or if I was a lawman who did like big important things, that how do you replace that thrill? But Tommy Lee Jones' character doesn't seem like he was really addicted, like an adrenaline junkie.
No, he doesn't.
Like they portrayed his entering that hotel room where he was morally certain that sugar was in as like the height of bravery.
Right.
Like, that is a man doing something stupid because he knows he must.
Yeah.
And then we as the audience know that for whatever reason, Sugar was in that room and spares his life.
Mm-hmm.
We see the brush of death that Tommy Lee Jones never did.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting and adds a huge level of suspense. And
now, it's also super ambiguous. I have a lot of questions about the ambiguities in this movie because there are a lot of them.
And I remember, so like, I felt like if you watched this movie enough, you would eventually have all the answers, because I felt like I had a lot of questions the first time I watched the movie that I remembered, and then as the second time, I'm like, oh, well, I missed this because I didn't know the significance of it. I feel like you watch this 4 or 5 times, most of these ambiguities will go away, but there might...
I think there are a few nagging ones. So I want to stay... We'll get to those. I want to get to the ambiguity later. I just want to stay on the themes. Too.
Okay.
Okay. But let's go over to Fate, because I feel like as much as this movie is about morality and this sort of No Country for Old Men type thing, I think it's also about fate. And that's represented... Honestly, I think you can almost call Sugar the force of fate here in this movie, in the way that, you know, it's a coin flip a lot of the time that determines whether or not he's going to kill you. And he, you know, he absolves himself of guilt for killing you by flipping this coin.
Yeah, the path I took to you is the same as the coin.
Right.
So
he leaves it up to the universe whether or not he's going to kill you. And I think disingenuously doesn't feel the guilt that way as much as, you know, as much as this man can feel guilt in any way.
So do you think, because I remember when we, in season one of Fargo, we had Eric on for some analysis, and he talked about... you know, this Cohen's unstoppable supernatural force and how that's a recurring. And you mentioned he's the force of fate. I saw a lot of analysis saying that he is essentially the Grim Reaper.
Okay.
He definitely has this mission he's trying to accomplish. And I saw one piece of really smart analysis that said that, like, the Anton has three different classifications of people. There's the people that are his mission that he shoots with his gun, and like there's very intent. There are the obstacles in his way, which get the captive bolt gun. Like, if it's a lock, pop. If it's a person he needs a car, pop. And then there's the ones that are everyone else that he just kind of walks among, and that's where he kind of takes the Reaper role, where it's fate. I'm going to flip a coin, and it's up the coin whether you live or die.
Right, and I think, you know, obviously you can interpret it however you want. I also see a lot of like comparisons to cattle and people as cattle. Like, you,
there you go.
This captive bolt pistol is used to kill, and Tommy Lee Jones tells the story.
Right.
How that can
go wrong.
And I don't know if he ever actually makes the connection.
I don't think he did.
And I think that's part of why he feels like he's failed. Right.
Yeah. He's over. I'm overmatched. I can't make the leap to treating a person, a human being, like a cow.
Exactly.
Even though I just described the device that's the central mystery of how this guy's killing him without a trace.
Right. So I don't know how that fits into like this obstacle format that that article set up.
It's objectification of humans. Like, you're treating them like a bolt. You're treating them like a piece of meat.
Right.
Or like, when I say bolt, sure. I mean a lock. You're treating them just like a physical impediment. Okay. So,
yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, like whether bolt. You treat them like a cow or it's all about the objectification of a human being.
Sure. But the reason I go to him being fate here and not like some force of evil that is ruled by fate necessarily is because he's because of the coin flip, and also you know, Josh Brolin's character, Llewellyn Moss, stumbles onto this money, right? It's not the choice that he makes to find this money. Now, he does make choices later on, but his journey is started by a flip of a coin.
Sure.
A chance of fate. And then in the end, like, it's impossible for Moss to resist his fate. He's killed by it in the end, right, because it all sets in motion, Sugar coming after him.
And off camera, reinforcing the point that part of the plot doesn't really matter.
Right. And then finally, fate turns on Anton in the final moments, where he kills Carla Jean, he slaughters her like cattle, and that's ambiguous, and I want to get your opinion on whether or not you think he actually killed her. I don't think it's ambiguous. I think it's implied in the movie.
Yeah, I don't think it's ambiguous at all. I think it's ambiguous in the same way that whether Leonardo DiCaprio is still in the dream at the end of Inception is. Like, if you've been paying attention to the film,
right,
you can the best argument you can make for her surviving is, well, we didn't see her die.
Right.
But then you got to answer the question of...
But all the other things in the movie say she did.
Why did Anton Sugar walk out and check his feet?
Right. If you've been watching, when he kills Wells, I think it is, Woody Harrelson's character, he lifts his boots up onto the bed to avoid getting blood on them.
And also, when he shoots the cartel member in the bathtub, he shuts the curtain. Like, he's obviously he can't avoid it all the time, but he's an experienced killer, and he's very cautious about that thing.
But specifically, he takes his boots off the floor.
Yes.
So he won't get blood on his boots. Now he's checking his boots for blood at the end. I think he's killed Carla Jean. The big ambiguity here, I guess, is whether or not Anton himself dies, because in a cruel twist of fate, he gets killed, or maybe not.
Well, and also I felt like he seemed troubled by that whole exchange. Like, this is the first time probably in his life where someone refused to make the call, and then he did.
Right.
He went ahead and then took matters in his own hands the way Carla Jean said you have to. Which, by the way, Kelly MacDonald from Boardwalk Empire, that's Nucky's wife.
Right. Sure is.
Playing like this hill jack, simple girl with a pretty convincing Texas drawl, I thought.
She's
Scottish.
She was good.
That she forced to confront his internal code, which we know from Woody Harrelson's character, Wells, is super important to him. It's almost like fate immediately took revenge upon him.
Right, some instant karma.
Yeah,
sort of thing.
And like that, I think, was really troubling to him. And it would be interesting to see what would become of this man after this movie.
I want to say he dies, unless he goes to a hospital. He either dies or gets arrested, in my opinion.
Because
he has a grievously injured arm.
He's got a compound fracture.
Right.
Like,
that's something
shit
you
that
can't
was,
fix yourself.
Was like, you'd have to amputate your arm. Like, in previous, up until the last 100 years, with modern surgical techniques and antibiotics, you were a dead man. Now, on the other hand, this guy has access to pretty extensive self-surgery. So could he numb his arm up and set the bone and pump himself full of antibiotics, or go to, like, what Llewellyn did, go to Mexico and go into a black market doctor?
Right. It's tough to imagine him getting there.
Do you think this is kind of like... I wonder... I mean, it seems impossible, but was this like a Jules from Pulp Fiction moment for him?
Where he's out of the game?
Yeah, he's
going
to walk the earth now.
Oh, no.
No?
I don't think that man ever gets out of the game.
I mean, I wouldn't think the Jules would get out of the game, too, if you'd, like, if you'd
That's
have
true.
Seen his...
Yeah.
Think about if you'd followed all of his adventures with Vince, and then the movie ended with him getting shot and walking out and saying, that was an act of God, and then you never saw the aftermath of that. I feel like that's how we left Sugar.
But we just didn't see the conversation in the diner where he resolves to be a hobo.
Right. Well, he would have no conversation. It'd just be something he would, you know, maybe he flips a coin and it's like, you know, I'm going to call it. And if I'm right, then I'll stay. This is all completely outside
all
the text.
All conjecture, right.
But I think the movie asks you to entertain this question of, like, what becomes of a man who seems like the only reason he's living his life is because of this code. Of dividing people into humans and cattle and bolts and innocents, and when that fails, and then he's immediately smacked for it. What does that do to
you? And he's so used to using fate as a tool to his own ends, or even possibly being fate, when fate turns on him, now how does he react?
Sure.
So I don't know whether he's dead or he gets out of the killing, the assassination game, or he gets arrested. I don't know. But ultimately, I think it's that cruel twist of fate that makes it.
I also like the fact that they show Josh Brolin's Moss character as a hunter, and they go right from, I mean, my God, the way Tommy Lee Jones' monologue sets this film up about how he's considering retirement because if he goes after too many guys like Sugar, then you have to essentially say, yep, I'm ready to become part of this world, and I feel like that would put one soul at hazard. Immediately cutting to Anton Sugar choking this cop and the look on his face.
Yeah. Like, oh, God, that guy's face.
That was like one hell of a character introduction. And then him getting like this guy, he says, hold still, sir. And he captive bolts this guy's forehead to get his car. And they immediately cut to Josh Brolin hunting deer. And he's whispering to the deer, like, hold still. Mm-hmm. And then the deer doesn't. And it looks like he got, instead of a clean death, like, this is all a metaphor that now Josh Brolin's character is going to be hunted by this thing that sees him as no more than a deer and wants, you know, it's like, hey, if you cooperate with me, you'll get a clean death. If not, you go down hard.
Yeah.
I'm not
certain on exactly what they're trying to say with all of these different themes because, you know, the hunter and the hunted do flip every so often in this film.
Right.
By the end, Josh Brolin seems to be the hunter.
Yeah.
Once again.
Well, humans are the most dangerous game, so.
It's true.
No mere deer.
Speaking of the hunting scenes, what do you make of what I see as parallels being drawn between Anton and Llewellyn, where Llewellyn in the beginning is hunting this deer, right? And he misses this shot.
Right.
This shot that as a hunter he should probably be able to make. You know, it's a tough shot.
I'm not
going to say it's an easy shot, but you get the impression that he has made this shot many times before.
Sure.
And then later in the movie, when Anton is driving across this bridge and he rolls down his window and takes a shot at a bird and misses point blank.
Here's the thing.
Fucking misses that bird.
So I rewound that.
Uh-huh.
There is like a blood spray from the bird. But then the bird flies off in almost exactly the same way that the deer took a hit but was made.
And then ran,
And then that's one of the things where I'm not sure what to make of that.
But it's in there intentionally. I mean, why else put that in the movie? They're drawing
parallels. I think
it's
to show that, like, it's to draw parallels. And the fact that, if I really think about this, Anton Sugar pursues death as a means of its own. Like, even when he doesn't have to, he likes to play these games where he can shoot something. Whereas Josh Brolin is hunting this deer for food, and after he winged it, mm-hmm. he goes to track it down to, you know, number one, give it a clean death, and number two, then, you know, drag it back for food for his family. In contrast to Sugar, who is just trying to kill something, wings it and doesn't, you know, like, whether that bird lives or dies, whether he hit the shot, missed a shot, he doesn't really give a shit.
Yeah.
But, what does that mean on a large... And that's the other thing. This is another film where you could really get up your own ass.
Oh, yeah.
And introduce themes that probably are not even there.
Yeah, and there's this idea of whether or not you can control fate, or whether or not you're ruled by fate, I guess. And, like, maybe it's paralleling something there with, like, you know, the two different characters sort of being opposite sides of it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but it is... It was a puzzling thing for me in the movie.
Why does Moss go back with a gallon jug of water?
It's because he's a decent human being, which ultimately is the thing that gets him killed.
Huh. Yeah.
Right?
Right.
I mean, it's sort of a little bit of old country in him, or old man in him.
Huh. So that he... I mean, that's the thing. So would you take this money?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure I would, too.
I don't see any reason not to.
It's $2 million in the 70s. That's a shit ton of money.
1980, if you want to get technical.
Is it 1980?
Yeah.
Because I thought they definitely did.
They say 58 and 22 years, and there's a tombstone with 1980 on it. And like
that's 78, though, right?
No, 58 plus 22. It's 1980, rather.
Oh, yes, it's 1980, exactly.
And there's a tombstone that says, okay, 1980, died 1980, so...
There you go. That's her mother that got shot.
Right.
Right.
Right. She got shot? Or did she die of cancer?
I thought she got shot. I thought she... some. Oh, really?
I thought she succumbed to cancer.
That would but be I don't incredible know how timing. Long. I assume that she got killed with the, you know, the Mexican gentleman.
Cartel or yeah. whatever, yeah.
That could they be. that she unwittingly talked too much.
Again, and, another ambiguity, right? Like, they don't explain that.
Right, right. I do feel like that there is, like, I feel like those are ones that you probably could answer if you went back and watched it. Because there's a lot, you know, there's right. a few people that were talking about how they, you know, for example, you have to pay attention, but when, you know... because he was like, well, how did they meet Moss in the middle of the night and just happen to be there at the same time? Whereas if you look, the cartel had come back and, like, cleaned up that site. And, like, you know, there's a new shotgun blast in the window where the guy who wanted Agua is killed. And they're
and they
clearly...
they had taken the drugs. Like,
they're taking the drug. They're yeah. clearly laying in wait to see who comes back. You know, they'd done the same tracking job he'd right. done and found the money. Or found that the money was missing. So, but that was, I mean, all that stuff is awesome too. Like his stalking the dead man and then how cautious he was waiting to see if he'd moved in a certain given period of time. And then the really awesome scene of these guys running him down at the break of dawn in this pickup truck.
Yeah.
You know, fugitive style. He's running from this runaway train and
he's gotta shoot the dog at the end.
It's, yeah. Like it's, and you, they really build up this Llewellyn to be this badass.
And then, and they do so many easy, like, very quick, you know, interesting things to convey how good he is at what he does. Like, the idea that he wouldn't just try and fire this wet gun, right? Like,
right.
he knows he's got to clean out the chamber. He's right. got to make sure there's no debris in it.
Right.
Like, all the little stuff he does.
Yeah. And, you know, that
he picks up his spent shells probably because he makes his own ammunition, like,
sure.
there's
or
a lot
he
of
just
stuff
doesn't want to litter,
but, maybe, yeah,
but yeah, I thought that was all good too. And they set this up to where it's like, wow, this is really seeing kind of these equals and opposites tracking right. each other, and that sometimes one outsmarts the other, sometimes the other outsmart. But they set up this, and then about the time where Carla Jean says he can take all comers, like, you're really solidified in your mind that okay, Llewellyn is going to regulate,
right.
And then almost right. immediately smash cut to the screaming at the hotel where he's lying there dead.
Yeah.
And it's already done. And you know, Tommy Lee Jones is like, oh, this is good. There's going to be this big shootout. And you're going to... They subvert all that.
They do, yeah. They don't actually show a lot of that kind of stuff in this movie. There are some one-on-one fights, which I'll talk about, you know, in a bit. Mm-hmm. But real quickly, going back to the cancer thing or the death of the mother there... I really feel like there's no country for cancer in this movie unless that's why she died. Because, like, I don't know why they would mention her cancer at all.
I thought it was
unless
just
it
that
killed her later.
Maybe she's the type that says she's got the cancer, but she doesn't really.
But where does that come into play, like, in the plot?
Makes her careless. Or just, I mean, they're okay, they're painting a certain, like, throughout the movie, they're painting a certain picture of this woman.
They are. She's real annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know, maybe giving her cancer is the way that they humanize her somehow. But she didn't seem...
Maybe.
Like, I've seen people dying of cancer, like, literally yeah. within days. And she does not look like that type of person.
Did she mention something about a ventilator or some kind of oxygen thing that she didn't have with her?
I don't think so.
No? Okay.
There's talk of, like, Anton having, like, you know, the one sheriff in the beginning was saying that he might have asthma because he's got some kind of tank and hose
well,
going
sure.
up his sleeve.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I don't remember.
Okay. I thought maybe when she was in the car going to the airport she'd mention that, but I
that
could be wrong.
Be. She was bitching about, you know, not knowing anybody, not having a house to go to.
Yeah.
I also, you know, the other thing about the kind of slow pleasure of this film is, like, watching Tommy Lee Jones drawing police work.
Oh, yeah. And he's just, so good at it, too.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just casually good at
and
it.
Very, in much the same way the lead of Fargo was, too. What was her name? The chief.
Uh-huh.
Shit, I can't remember her name. Marge.
Yeah, Marge Gunderson, right.
The same way that she's just, like, casually... Because I think that we are ingrained, especially if you're in the coast of the country, to hear a Southern accent and just assume they're fucking stupid.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, shows like Justified and this subvert that because you've got I mean, his sheriff's deputy seems like he's kind of a dipshit.
Uh-huh.
But then again, he's also doesn't have the experience that Tommy Lee Jones. Like, Tommy Lee Jones, no one would call him dumb. And he's just going through and effortlessly reconstructing this stuff and picking up on details this other kid's not and showing. But I don't know, because I've got a little bit of drawl in me. A lot of people don't know this, but I spent a couple years of my teenage years in Central Texas.
As a walnut-faced sheriff, so.
Not at all, but no? Like, okay. And my brother and sister have noticeably more Southern twang because they were younger and more impressionable, and their accents drifted a hell of a lot more than mine did. So, like, I don't know, like, I know a lot of Southern smart people.
Sure, sure. I mean, you know, accent is not necessarily an indicator of intelligence.
No, but I do feel like a lot of the country assumes it is. And it's not just that. You also hear, like, this outrageous Bronx accent, and you think they're dumb fucks, too.
Yeah, I mean, it comes along with a certain way of life, this sort of this sort of old Western life feel, right? You get the idea when you hear that accent that area hasn't progressed much beyond that sort of civilization. But in actuality, they have.
Right.
And you know, that's sort of a lament of Tommy Lee Jones here in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about, you know, the slow sort of understated pacing of this movie is to go along with the music is how well it works in kind of conveying the landscape, like intertwined with the landscape, like this idea of very little sound in this movie really works well for me. It creates an atmosphere that I don't feel in a lot of other movies.
It sells the isolation too.
Yeah.
Like when Moss is out hunting in the mountains, it's like there's not a fucking soul around.
Yeah. You just hear the report of the rifle.
Which is probably why the drug dealers picked that spot as the way to do their deal, right?
Yep.
So what do you make of the fact that coins are prominent in this film? Both as when Antoine's flipping it, and there was some analysis about talking about his quarter, of like there's also another meaning of the word quarter, which is to show like mercy or to stay in execution. Like when you say, give the enemy no quarter,
right?
That means you're not, whereas he's literally giving his victims quarter.
Yeah.
I thought that, I don't know if that was intentional, but I thought that was cool. But the other prominent use of coins is as tools to open, especially vents. Is there some kind of connection there?
What did you say?
So there's two. If you think of the times you see coins in a movie, it's either Antoine flipping it or someone, Antoine usually using a dime because Llewellyn had his knife. The Antoine noticeably uses a dime to work the screws of the vent.
Well, a quarter's too fat.
Well, just. But is there some association with that? And that's also what Tommy Lee Jones had kind of tipped him off when he was in the room.
Right, he saw the dime and the screws.
The dime was laying there. Is there some, other than just the character being associated with dimes, that kind of bothered me. And like, what am I not getting here?
Right.
You got any ideas on that?
I don't. I do like the quarter thing in its multiple meanings. And I'm pretty sure that had to be running through their head at some point during the creation of this film. But I really love the way that they have the coin, that they make the coin ominous in the beginning, because the first coin flip works out for the guy. And you get the impression that something very, very bad is going to happen to him.
Yeah. And the man is aware of that.
You understand that he's going to die.
Yeah.
If this coin flip doesn't go his way.
Sure.
And so we as an audience go, this is a very ominous thing
this
coin flip is. Yeah.
And again, no music. It's just
Antoine's
just not putting up with this guy and his bullshit and his explanations and his justifications. And
And so that first flip, you don't get to see the outcome, right?
Right.
And so I know that this is a difference between the books and the movies, but with Carla Jean, you actually, like, she does call it. In the book, apparently.
Okay, because I didn't delve into the differences between the book and because I haven't seen the book.
I scratched the surface on it.
Okay,
and it seems like there were very few. Like this is a very faithful adaptation.
Yeah,
except in a few crucial.
I guess the hotel scene. There was a viewer that wanted us to discuss that, but I didn't even include that part of the feedback because I've not read the book and.
Yeah, me either.
I don't feel right to just like read a Wikipedia synopsis and then be like, oh well, here's the
Yeah,
like that's.
But I found it interesting that they don't actually ever show you the aftermath of a coin flip gone wrong, a coin flip that doesn't work out for the victim.
How many coin flips are there?
Just one. Just that one. I mean, well, there's two, but Carla Jean refuses to call it in the
movie. Okay, I thought maybe there was a third that.
I don't
think yeah, I so. Think you're right. I think because he doesn't give Woody Harrelson the opportunity.
No,
he just shoots him when the phone rings.
Yeah. So I'm a little curious why they didn't include that in the same way that the books does, because then you get the aftermath of the coin flip, right? Like Carla Jean calls it, she doesn't call it correctly, and she dies.
From that description, I like the movies better because Carla Jean sticks to her guns and Antoine has to compromise on his principles.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I like it thematically better. I just don't... It doesn't feel as satisfying with the coin necessarily.
Okay, yeah.
From a storytelling perspective,
I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. But I do... Like, I'm actually surprised that that's a difference in the book is like, wow, I feel like that's on its face inferior.
And it's a significant change.
But on the other hand, like, you know, when you're writing this awesome work, obviously the movie, a lot of its dialogue and stuff is lifted right out of there. You know, you don't know that maybe there's a better way to do something because you're too close to it.
Sure.
Did you get from the book that she initially said, I'm not going to call it, and then she just got afraid and, you know, called it?
Yeah. I think there's, like, a lot of pressure to call it, and she finally does,
it's
like,
the prisoner's dilemma. Like, you know, if you don't cooperate, you're probably going to die. Mm-hmm. If you do cooperate, you literally have a 50-50 chance of winning until you find out that Sugar's coin is double-headed or something. Shit like that.
Well, you always go double-tails. If you're going to do a trick coin, go double-tails, because everybody calls heads.
Do they?
I do.
See, I'm a contrarian, so I like to call tails.
Okay.
Hasn't worked out for me in our working relationship.
No, it hasn't. We have our own coin of destiny here, our coin of doom.
Yep.
That determines all actions within the Bald Move Empire.
Pretty much. Day-to-day type stuff, anyway.
Yep.
And I wish we'd kept a running total, because I'm pretty sure it's about 80-20 in your favor.
Probably.
If I had to guess.
Sounds right.
Which, god damn it, either this coin's not properly weighted or the law of average is going to kick in and you're going to have a rough year or two coming up, but I don't know.
Yep.
So you said there's not a lot of humor, but I thought there's a lot of understated humor in, like, especially if you know the central West Texas area, that, like, the clothing store guy... The guy comes in, he needs boots, and then he comes in the second half of the movie, needs everything but the and the clothing store guy's not plussed about it. He's like, bet that you don't see this very often. He's like, yes, sir, it's unusual.
Right.
Like, I thought that was super funny.
It is. There's also some really, like, morbid black humor in this, where Anton Sugar goes next door and kills three men in his socks. Like, he's taking off his boots and he's walking around this hotel in his socks, killing people.
Right.
Pretty good stuff. I just can't. One thing I can't abide. I cannot abide calling a screwdriver a scroogie.
Scroogie? Yeah. I don't...
He calls it a scroogie. Is this a man who would call a screwdriver a scroogie?
I don't know if that's a regional kind of thing. Like they call water fountains bubblers in Rhode Island or Massachusetts. I don't know. It's goofy until you live down there and that's all you know.
I guess.
So, what did you make of the fact that the last time we see Moss alive, he is winning the morality war?
Yeah.
That he's not going to sleep with this woman who's obviously gagging for it. Mm-hmm. Then next time we see him, the hotel's all shut up and he's dead. Did he fall from grace in that? I mean...
I don't think so, because she's still at the pool. Because she ends up dead in the pool, and he ends up dead in his hotel room. So, I don't think so.
Okay. So what was the point of that? Was that just like, you know, a nice little vignette?
I mean, I think you need to, at that point, show something that gives Josh Brolin's character a little hint of positive morality. Because at that point, he's made the decision not to save Carla Jean. He's made the decision to keep the money and not go to the police, endangering himself and his family.
He's made the decision not to save Carla Jean. I think he's made the decision.
Right, no, Anton gives... Well, not to take the easy way, like the sure way to save her, to think that he can do it himself. And I feel like that's...
Do you think that he believed Anton? That's the thing. Like, I don't...
Well, maybe not.
Like, I feel like killing Anton is the only thing in his mind that would save Carla Jean.
It could be. But certainly, like, not going to the police and protecting his family from these killers, that's a moral decision that is not... It is not passable. I mean, he wants to keep the money. He's greedy.
It's classic Walter White. Like, if he had gone to, there's a couple places where, you and I would have taken the money, but the second, you know, dangerous people.
The second a killer comes after me, I'm probably going to...
Yeah, if I survive the encounter with the fucking dog.
Right.
But it's like, that's the thing. Like, if he would have gone through and looked for the transponder, which, why would you? I guess I would have.
I would
it
take
was on
the money
the top
out of the bag,
fucking
yeah.
layer. I would have taken it out and counted it and seen if there's like, you know.
And it's weird to me why, like, when he's in his hotel room looking in the bag, he doesn't dump the money out.
Uh-huh.
Like, dump the money out. Strip the bag. Like, it might be built into the bag.
Right.
You need to ditch the receptacle.
Yeah.
And put the money in a backpack or something.
Agreed.
And search every square inch of it to make sure there isn't, like, a crazy dye pack or some
sure.
other shit in there.
Yeah, you want to know all that before you get too in too deep.
I would think so.
But, yeah, that if assuming I survived the dog, which probably I wouldn't. I'd probably drowned in the river or gotten ran over by the Jeep or gotten shot. I probably would have gone to the cops and been like, hey, I would have put the best face on it, but...
Here's what I'd do. I'd take half the money out. I'd say, hey, I found this
there
money.
There you go. Look at all this money I found.
Right. So I think it's to bring him back around to the side of good.
Yeah.
Although as far as to settle the score morally.
I didn't think any of his actions... You're right. They were kind of calloused and calculated on the fact that he was... Full, you know, way too full of himself and how deadly he was. But then again, he'd been to Vietnam, and they hinted that there's, you know, this felt very Copperhead Road to me. Like, this guy, he's seen a lot of shit, and he's done a lot of shit, and he feels very rough and competent, and this is his golden opportunity. This is his meal ticket. It's like, no longer am I going to have me and my wife in this shitty trailer, and I have to hunt deer. She's going to have some pretty dresses, and I'm going to have some fancy boots, and
right.
going to make it.
Yeah.
Going to make it. This is a country for young men, and I'm a young man, and I'm going to make it.
Sure.
We talked about Tommy Lee Jones going into room 114 and how I thought it might be the bravest thing a person's ever done in cinema, because you can... That's okay. The thing, like, he's not the action... He's not... Like Tommy Lee Jones in The Fugitive, where nothing bad can happen to him. This is a fearful Tommy Lee Jones that is aware of his mortality and almost meta aware that a cop who's announcing retirement in a movie, like, he feels the bullseye on him at all times. Like, ah, damn it, here's another lock shot out.
Yep.
What am I doing here? But I'm a lawman, so here I go.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of other kind of, you know, not necessarily large themes in this movie, but little nuggets of wisdom, I suppose. Like, when he's talking to his uncle, he says basically all the time, you spend trying to get back what you lost, that just means more is going out the door.
Right.
So let it go.
Kind of like, it's interesting because just this week there was an article I saw on Reddit where somehow they scientifically studied how people feel when they've gotten revenge.
Okay.
And how that, like, psychologically, it's people that don't get the revenge they want are healthier than the people that do get the revenge. Mm-hmm. It's an empty, hollow feeling. And I thought that was interesting, that essentially if you go around and you worry about the things that you've lost and wanting to right those wrongs, what are you, you know, like you said, what's going out the front door? What's bleeding?
Yeah.
You know, you're not, what if you never get that blood back?
Yeah. Or when you do, it doesn't satisfy, it doesn't actually give you back what you've lost.
Exactly.
You could be making the most of your life instead of spending it on the past.
Speaking of ambiguities of the film, I'm still a little confused about the relationship between Wells, Woody Harrelson's character, and Josh Brolin's Moss.
In what way?
So, chronologically... Wells tracks Moss down at the hospital in Mexico where he's staying. It seems that Moss rebuffs his efforts to, you know, form some kind of alliance where he gets the money and he gives him a cut and he helps him with the sugar problem.
Does he?
Well, I'm just saying that's where they lead the conversation. Next scene, we see Woody Harrelson walking on the bridge and like retracing his steps and almost preternaturally determining, oh, this lighthouse, I'm going to climb up here and I'm going to, you know, look and, oh, there's the briefcase. Then he doesn't collect it. Next time we see Woody Harrelson, he's getting held up by Sugar. Sugar kills him. And then Llewellyn calls Woody Harrelson.
Uh-huh.
So did he make a deal that, like, recovered a briefcase? If he did, why didn't he recover the briefcase then and there?
So my impression of this is, yeah, he did make a deal. Because how else would Woody Harrelson know where the money is? Woody Harrelson goes there. He checks it out. He says... This is broad daylight. I can't go down here and get this money.
Without attracting attention.
Right. I'm going to wait
Okay.
to get the money. And he goes back to his hotel to bide his time. But by then, Sugar's already taken, I guess, usurped power over this hotel. Like, how many clerks has he killed at this point? Because the guy he kills says at 10 a.m. my shift is changing, and I assume someone else is coming to relieve him. So has he killed another clerk? Because days have passed at this point.
Yeah.
So he's running this hotel now. Sugar's at the front desk in his bellhop's uniform.
Right.
Taking phone calls, just waiting for the assassins to show up.
You don't want to ring the bell at the counter.
You don't.
You really don't.
No.
Because he'll come out and use the captive bolt gun on the bell, and it'll split your ears open.
Also, he doesn't carry luggage. Forget that. No. That's right out.
No, I mean, apparently he doesn't even have a car. Like, if he needs a car, he goes and murders this person and gets the car. If he needs clothes, he goes and buys them off a little kid or, you know, whatever he needs.
So, I mean, that's my assumption.
That was another...
That he's waiting to collect it later.
That was another interesting moment. The comparing and contrasting the little kid who selflessly is like, I'll give you the shirt off my back, to the college kids that were trying to extort Llewellyn for beer.
Uh-huh.
Like, and then the one of his friends like, look at this guy. Is this the guy you really want to take for a ride?
Right.
I don't know exactly where I'm going with this or what that means, but I thought it was an interesting contrast.
Yeah, I mean, it could be a little glimmer of hope in the No Country for Old Men sort of feeling, where, you know, some of these kids, you know, some of the younger men are not as bad as, you know,
Sure, they're not all
would be.
They're not all weird cult member rapists preying on old people and cashing social security checks, you know.
Right, or even just college kids trying to get everything they can out of this guy who's clearly not in a good way.
I don't have a lot more to say about this. Again, the movie looks amazing. It's visually arresting, and it uses that impact to get away with like ludicrously long scenes that are quiet and nothing's happening. Like, you know, how long do you think passed between, like Moss becoming aware of the transponder and then Anton Sugar sliding up, like 2-3 minutes, no dialogue, just a look on Josh Brolin's face and you know, trusting the audience to be smart enough to kind of keep up. I thought that was kind of incredible.
So I think my favorite scene in this whole movie is that scene. Not him actually finding the transponder, but everything that happens after that.
Sure.
I mean, that shootout
that
goes from hotel room to street is amazing.
It really is. It's a cat and mouse game between people that feel very evenly matched.
Absolutely.
And you wonder if it wasn't for the wild card of the Mexican cartel hunting Moss, if he wouldn't have triumphed.
Yeah, maybe. Like, I mean, he did just get the jump.
If it was just one-on-one, he would have been able to take him. But it was essentially one-on-one on an endless sea of mooks.
Right. The thing that I really like about it is the little details that they have. Like, this... So he gets in this truck, right? And he's like, drive me out of here. You need to get me out of here. And he's trying to hitchhike with this guy.
Oh, God.
And this guy gets shot in the neck
and
then through the head multiple times. And then he's got to drive this car down the road. And he sees the shots coming from in front of him. And he's like, well, I can't see where he is. So what he decides to do is duck down, drive straight forward, watch his side window. And when that gets blown out, he knows he's past him.
Right.
That's just such a small detail that is so cool.
They really
sell
how smart these guys are.
They really do, yeah. I mean, everything from him hiding the money in the air vents where it was accessible from another room.
Getting the room on the other side so that it put the cartel guys off. Yeah, super smart.
And I don't know that there's any music playing during that scene.
I don't think so.
Or if it is, it's so minor that I didn't even notice it.
I mean, that's the contrast in The Godfather because like it mostly props up its big there you go, underscores its big moments, like Michael in the hospital. It's got that dong and like this like tension building music, whereas that's essentially the same scene.
Right.
Or think of the music behind like the Settling All Family Business, you know, the operatic stuff. Like those are essentially the same scenes, and No Country for Old Man's like, fuck your music.
I don't need it.
Don't need it. Like, people are going to not be breathing in the cinema, and the silence is going to be, it's going to be like in a church in there, because people just are on pins and needles about what's going to happen next.
Yeah. I have one more question.
Okay.
As far as ambiguity goes. So, there's the shootout at the hotel between the cartel and someone, maybe Josh Brolin, maybe Anton's part of it.
Yeah,
we don't really know.
Crossfire, sure.
Yeah, he might have. But Tommy Lee Jones rolls up and they do the investigation there. And then he goes back to that room later on where Anton is hiding. Is Anton actually hiding in that room? And if so, how does he get out of that room without Tommy Lee Jones seeing him?
Well,
I want to suggest something crazy here in a second. If you don't bring it up first.
The Wikipedia article asserts that Sugar is hiding behind the door.
Okay.
However, if he is...
Uh-huh.
And what's weird is I thought that I remembered a scene where we see this perspective of, like, Sugar hiding behind the door and Tommy Lee Jones standing in the doorway. Yet, I was...
You don't ever see that.
That
yeah.
didn't... Okay. And I don't know whether that was an expanded edition or if there's a director's cut, because I know that there's deleted scenes that one can go out and see.
But it's clearly in the movie two separate camera angles.
Yeah. If he is, in fact, hiding behind the door, then that implies that Tommy Lee Jones did see him and decided that he essentially blinked. Like,
I'm
just going to walk out, and then I'm going to retire. Because that's essentially what happens. Bad guy gets away scot-free. Well, with a
so you're saying Tommy Lee Jones walks in the bathroom, checks the window, comes back out and sees him, and then walks right out the door?
And retires.
Okay.
That's not exactly what I think happened. I think, Sugar, this is kind of like one of those things where he is a little bit supernatural.
Okay.
Like when Tommy Lee Jones, like he could have, and I think it's fairly easy that he could have taken his boots off and like moseyed out the front door while Tommy Lee Jones is flipping the lights on in the bathroom.
Sure. I don't have a huge problem with that.
But I do think that Sugar's definitely in that room when he walks in.
Okay. I'm going to propose something crazy here.
All right. I want to hear it.
That these two separate camera angles, one showing Sugar, one showing Belle.
Mm-hmm.
Are actually happening in two separate rooms, and that this is a callback to what Llewellyn does with hiding the money and taking the second room and pulling the money out.
Why would Sugar do that?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you exactly why he would do that.
I can understand why he'd pop the lock and be lying in wait for the cartel to beep. Or, well,
from,
by this
from
time,
what I can tell, like the. There are two rooms cordoned off in this crime scene, like this one and the one next door, where I think the Mexican was killed, okay. Like one of the Mexicans was killed.
Okay.
Like they were staying in the room next to Josh Brolin, and one of them was killed there. So he might be in that other room. I'm not certain. But why would he take the money from Josh Brolin's room, from Llewellyn's room, and then go into the other room and wait around? That wouldn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It was just one theory I saw floating around.
Yeah, I mean, and I like it because it's a callback and all that, but that's, I think, by far the most ambiguous scene in the whole movie.
Yeah.
And again, I don't know if it's, I guess that's the thing that I think, but how do you describe something of, like, you think that's what's happened, but you don't personally subscribe to it?
I get what you're saying.
You know,
but
like
I can't
the fact that Tommy Lee Jones would see him there and then walk out and then just read that was like, that's it. Like, this is doing damage to my soul.
Mm-hmm.
I was brave enough to go in here, but now my worst fears are confirmed that I'm going to whistle past this particular graveyard. I don't know what you, but that's what I think happened, but I don't have any proof for it. And I also, it feels kind of unsatisfying that. Because they could have showed
right,
that.
Right, where I think the callbacks feel a little more satisfying.
That would have been like a moment where like the German sneaks down the staircase with Upchuck, the translator.
Right, in
after
Saving
he
Private
just,
Ryan.
Mellish, was that the guy's name?
I don't
Or was that the guy he
names.
Killed? But it's that kind of thing where you see like death walking out and like, shh, you know, that would have been a really chilling scene.
Right.
And they didn't go there either because they liked ambiguity or because... They were trying to imply something else.
Yeah.
And again, it's right
within... It might just be the Coens liking ambiguity, because they do.
And they do. That's like that's kind of like, you know, how did fucking... shit, the dude from the first season of Fargo. I've completely spaced his name. The demonic Which character.
Bob, what's his name? Lester? No. Nope,
not the other guy.
Malvo.
Lorne Malvo. Right. Like, how did he get out of the basement?
Remember, like, that thing where he's down and there's another scene where, like, he supernaturally turns out the lights and disappears from, like, a bathroom with no exit.
Yeah.
I think sometimes, and just like, you know, the Mad Max dude in Raising Arizona, like, sometimes they like to throw in a little bit of impossibility to give it an otherworld quality.
Yeah, and that Fargo stuff might have been a direct callback to this scene.
Because
Tommy Lee Jones goes in that bathroom.
Right.
Checks that window that's still locked.
Right.
I don't know. That's one of the biggest questions I have, I guess.
Okay.
You know, other than, I guess, does Anton die in the end? I suppose there are other questions, like, why was the transponder in the money in the first place? But you
can Stephen
never know
Rude
that.
I think Steven Rude is a smart businessman. He wanted to protect his investment.
Right. And I don't think it needs an answer in the same way that that bathroom scene does,
right?
Or that hotel room scene does.
Well, we have a No Country sized mailbag that I don't even know what that means, but we have a fairly large mailbag from our contributors here. Would you like to get into that, or do you have a couple more closing thoughts?
One more slight ambiguity here.
Okay.
Woody Harrelson is talking to Steven Root, and he's trying to make jokes and stuff, and Steven Root isn't interested. He doesn't think he's funny. Before he leaves, he says, hey, I counted the floors in this building from the outside, and there's one missing. Now, some people... Okay, one way to interpret that is, you know, the standard, like, 13-story... like, 15-story building. Sometimes they skip 13 because it's unlucky.
Right.
And in the elevator, they'll just put... like, it'll number them up to 16, and 13 will be left out.
Right. I think that's the correct interpretation.
And that's him trying to make another stupid joke.
And it also fits in with the themes of luck and fate.
Okay, fair enough. The other, and I think you're right. I think that's what he means. The other possibility.
That floor represents limbo that the character, yeah.
Right. No, but that there is actually a floor that's not numbered in the public elevators. And that there's some nefarious shit going on for, let's say, the top floor.
I mean, that's a plausible theory, but there's nothing within the universe to suggest that.
Right.
I mean, it's very much like the people that try to figure out what's really in the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. Well, it's Vin Rhames' soul. I mean, he's got the Band-Aid on his neck, and that's where everyone knows that the devil takes the soul out. And
right, or it's a gold bar.
What would glow gold? But what's more beautiful than a human soul? And like, okay... that's the story you want to tell yourself. It's cool. It's a cool theory, but yeah.
It's a Men in Black-esque universe in a keychain sort of thing. No. Okay, so I think there are ways to tell that he's just trying to make another joke here.
Right. Like, I mean, it follows another lame joke of, like, validating parking, something that no one in this situation would have reasonably asked for. And the guy, like, makes it clear that you're trying my patience, of Woody follows it up with yet another one.
Sure.
Just to be like, I don't
just
give a
fuck. Just
to
stick it to him.
Yeah, this is the, you know, I'm... And it's interesting, because they set up Woody Harrelson's character of Wells to be this big swinging dick.
And he does nothing.
He is not big nor swinging.
Right, honestly, I feel you could have cut him out of this movie entirely and lost nothing.
He's a flim-flam man. Well...
I don't think you lose anything, honestly.
You're probably right, but this film is actually kind of trim already. It's just a scant 2-hour runtime.
I think cut it down to 145 and leave him out, frankly. Huh.
I don't know. I feel like he's the anti-Tommy Lee Jones. The guy who
that he's fresh-faced and...
Like, he just doesn't... Well, yeah, he doesn't have
and
a
corrupt.
Face that looks like a catcher's mitt made of butthole or out of buttholes.
or an underfilled bag of walnuts. Half a bag of walnuts.
Or a summer squash that decided for some reason to hang around the winter.
or an underfilled bratwurst. Either way.
A face that looks like at some point he was trying to pick out the Holy Grail and got the answer half right and half wrong. Somehow. I don't even know how that happens, but that's what his face looks like.
To me, it looks like a pottery student's failed final project.
Please, he left the bust of Tommy Lee Jones in the kiln too long.
Now it's all cracked and craggy.
Oh, man. No, like, the Tommy Lee Jones is uber aware of his mortality and his limitations and his ability to confront these things, whereas Woody Harrelson, he is all talk. He's all hat and no cattle, as they say in Texas.
Okay. I like it.
You know, Tommy Lee Jones survives, this guy doesn't.
Yeah.
which is, you know, it's a weird worldview. It's one of those instances where I don't subscribe to the worldview espoused in this show.
Can you define that easily? The worldview you don't subscribe to?
That the world is a terrible, evil place that you cannot confront it without being changed by it, and it's best to avoid it.
To look away.
To look away and to, you know, I don't know, maybe do as much good as you can, but you know when the getting's good and get out of there because,
okay.
You know, you're also, I think you're supposed to, you say, oh, look how bad things were in the 80s and it's so much worse nowadays. Whereas any measurable statistic you want to look at shows that we are far better off in 2016 than we are in the 80s or the 70s.
Right.
Or really any point in history.
Like, and I think that's...
Violent crime, rapes, all this, every measure of statistics you can use says that we are in a safer, gentler environment than we've ever been. We are not, like, we were not in a golden age and we've slowly slid to hell. That's the story that everyone wants to tell you for whatever reason, because it sells newspapers, it keeps you glued to the sets. I don't think there's any nefarious, like, New World Order type shit. I think it's just people trying to make a buck. But as a result, you know, if it leads, it bleeds. Well, if it stops bleeding, it's no longer leading. Fucking magnify the shit that bleeds. But I think that that's kind of... But I don't have to subscribe to something's worldview to see the merits of its artistic vision.
Right,
like, you know, Fight Club is still awesome, even if I think it's dumb that people think that Tyler Durden had a point.
Okay.
You know?
Sure.
You know, Mr. Robot is still unambiguously great, even though I feel like a lot of the shit that they're trying to say about modern day society is heavy-handed and ultimately not factually correct.
Sure.
And
honestly, I don't know that this movie necessarily tries to say one way is correct and one way isn't of viewing the world, because there are several different outlooks espoused here. I mean, Tommy Lee Jones in the beginning is lamenting the fact that he's, you know, essentially that he's got to carry a gun, that he can't be like these old lawmen.
The ones who got paralyzed in gunfights?
Well, who reputedly, like, didn't carry guns.
Right.
And did just fine, you know? Were able to carry out the law without it. But then you have the story of the uncle, like you said.
That shows that he was
wrong
about
that.
That
shows that the people have always been the same, the problems are always the same. Right.
Yeah.
So, like, you do have a couple of different worldviews. And then you've got, you know, what Tommy Lee Jones comes around to at the end, which is there are, like, it's a harsh, unfeeling world in a lot of ways, and there's nothing I can do to change that.
Right.
So you have, like, three different worldviews kind of summed up in this movie, and I don't know that the movie really picks one. I guess it leans toward Tommy Lee Jones' epiphany at the end.
I forgot to mention this because I wrote it down in my notes, and now I'm kind of going through for a second pass. The thing that convinced me about Tommy Lee Jones not being comforted by his father's dream is he says, "And then I woke up." Like, right. I was presented this comforting story that I've got this warm place prepared for me, but the Coen's nihilism kicks in and says, "Then I woke up and realized that I'm just heading into the abyss."
Or it could be, "I woke up," meaning I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that works out for anybody.
Right.
You know,
like, right.
There are multiple ways, and it all depends on how you interpret it. It's art.
Right.
But I don't think, I do think it leans in the direction you said, which is nihilism.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a well-worn Coen brothers thing to wallow in. I mean, sometimes they treat it as it's almost weird. Like, maybe this is the young Coens versus the progressively older cousins. Like, they're kind of cavalier and joking about it in the Big Lebowski, and yet a lot of their later works seem to embrace it as a fact of life.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, are we ready for feedback now?
Also, speaking of Coen brother stuff,
we are never getting the feedback.
We're never going to happen. there's apparently a lot of parallels to Raising Arizona in this. I've recently watched Raising Arizona, and the only one I saw was the trailer. Looks real similar, but
It wouldn't surprise me.
I mean, those kind of unstoppable forces, the assassins, finding a bunch of money. You know,
money is the
having
child.
This MacGuffin sort of thing. But that's kind of standard fare for movies. It's not in particular at Raising Arizona.
I mean, if you boil down stories to the archetype of, like, you know, man versus man versus himself, man versus nature. It's like all movies are the same.
Yeah.
You know,
it does have a similar feel at times, although Raising Arizona is much funnier, in my opinion. Oh. Much more ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't think that's your opinion. I think it's a fact. I think that's a fact, yeah. Raising Arizona is objectively hilarious. Now, can we get the feedback?
Sure.
All right. Keith Alejandro says, No Country and There Will Be Blood were filmed at the same time in the same deserted section of West Texas.
What?
In fact, production on No Country for Old Men was halted at one point because of the out-of-control oil derrick fire and smoke that was on the horizon from the There Will Be Blood shoot.
Wow.
I thought that was a pretty cool little detail that he had picked up in his either DVD watching or IMDb. Diving. Matt the Reamer from Boston said, I saw this in the theaters back in 2007 and really liked it, but haven't rewatched it in full until just last night. When I first saw the movie, I was very, very angry that Moss/Brolin died off screen. Upon rewatch, I'm not so upset. Ultimately, the movie was more about Bell and Jones, even though Moss Brolin got more screen time. During the first watch, I would describe it as jarring to see Moss or dead, which I think is the point. We've switched to Bell's point of view at that point, and he was shocked and saddened by it. I've never read the original 2005 Cormac McCarthy book. When I saw it in the theater, one of my friends that had, much like the book versus show on Game of Thrones, he had negative reactions to it. The one I remember even now is his response to the motel scene, which apparently was quite a bit different. But again, I haven't read the book, so I can't really commentary. He did express amazement here that, think about that, the original book came out in 2005, and the movie was out in 2007.
It's a pretty quick turnaround.
Like, the Coens must have, like, optioned that and turned it around. But then I also did some research for my Orange and New Black podcast last night. They make passing reference to this book in Orange and New Black. They show the cover of it. I forget what it's the Yiddish Policeman's Union is what it was. That director, that author, the Coens contacted him within like months of the book's release and optioned the film rights. And they made a script for it, and then they didn't do anything with it, and 2 years later they reverted the rights back. So maybe that's something they do. Like, they're like voracious readers and like, holy shit, this is something we want to sink our teeth into, and it either works out or it doesn't. But they seem very agile. I mean,
yeah,
this movie seems like something that would take a fuck ton of planning and research, and it just doesn't seem like there's enough time in 2 years to make that all happen.
They're quick. They're good at it.
They are. They've had some experience by this point. Bonus points for firearms realism with the Moss Brolin action in the beginning. He says, no comment on the noiseless silencers, though. I write this off to cinematic license, which I'm okay with, since it made Sugar even more of a ghostly, unstoppable silent killer. So I actually looked up if it's possible to silence a shotgun, and I was surprised. I found a YouTube video of a guy testing a shotgun silencer, and on the video, the firing pin sound was louder than the report of the gun, and he said if he described it in person, it's like a person clapping their hands together.
Wow.
So, shockingly effective.
Although, you know, the shotgun itself is apparently anachronistic. Like,
really?
It was made in 1987, according to what I read, and, like, it's only 1980 in the movie, so... Okay. Well, whatever. I don't care.
There's those types of guns for sure. One. But no, I thought that I wouldn't have believed. My first thought was like, there's no fucking way you can have a non-destructive silencer that's effective. And it's certainly not the that you see in a scene.
Right.
But you know,
yeah, silence PP7 from GoldenEye sound.
Right. Right. On reflecting on some of the reasons I like this movie so much, I realize that all of the players in this cat and mouse game are clever, but not perfectly so, making them more realistic and three-dimensional. Sugar, for example, clever enough to take off his shoes when sneaking around, but not so clever that he doesn't get shot. Moss, clever enough to do everything he does, but he still gets beat by three assailants. Wells, clever enough to find Moss in a Mexican hospital, but not clever enough to avoid Sugar. No character does anything unbelievably stupid. They just get momentarily bested, like Bell's fake story about the farmer to Moss's wife. Yeah, that's the thing that really sells the cat and mouse game, that these are not, this isn't like fucking Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible. This is, you know, like a believably smart, resourceful characters trying to kill each other.
And, you know, the idea that we talked about where Tommy Lee Jones may or may not actually put together that bolt, that captive bolt pistol thing. He might not even understand what he's seeing necessarily.
Well, he even points it out to, like, can you imagine He said, I can't remember the exact words, but he's like, if you can, I defy you to try to imagine this crime. And he tells the story about the people that are abducting senior citizens, torturing them, killing them, and cashing Social Security checks.
Yeah.
I feel like that's this, like, he literally can't imagine adapting this way to efficiently slaughter cattle to human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we already talked about that. Also, we didn't talk about the performances. Like, I mentioned right. Kathy McDonald in passing, but, like, everybody here crushes it. We talked a lot about Tommy Lee Jones, who plays almost like he gives a kind of performance that, like, Johnny Cash did in that late cover album he does. Like, something's like, man, you didn't know he's capable of throwing 100-mile-an-hour heat right. still. And he does. Like, there's something about his weather-beaten, butt-holy face.
Desiccated cabbage
and
face.
And how sad his eyes are. Like, this right. just really beat him down. And also, yeah. Javier Bardem? Is it Bardem?
I think it's Bardem. Bardem?
This
Bardem?
Guy is almost too good. Because yeah. I can't think of anything I've seen him in besides the James Bond film.
Okay, sure.
Which was Skyfall, right? He was in the big
in
bad in Skyfall.
I don't remember.
He can't be a character actor because he's just so undelible with these type of insane, unhinged performances.
Yeah. Yeah. His eyes, his smile, it's all, ugh.
Yeah. Like creepy. The poster that just has his eyes kind of overlooking everything. I've seen one version where it's just, you know, it's not his whole face. It's kind of like just it's just really creepy. Hmm. This guy is just unfucking hinged. It's what makes the scene in the general store, the gas station, work. Just, he's so fucking menacing.
He just needs his Nucky role. He needs the role that takes him from bug-eyed freak to respectable actor. And I think if he could find that Nucky-type role,
there you go.
He'd be good.
There you go. Let's move on to his next point. More confirmation that the movie is really more about Bell and not Moss. During my Wikipedia deep dive, it was mentioned that the book and movie title are taken from a Yeats poem about the agony of growing old.
Right.
Bell is clearly struggling with this. He can't deal with the world he's living in as a police officer or as a retiree. His father and uncle died young, and I think he expected this too, which is perhaps why he went into the motel room without backup. His ghostly killer wasn't there, so now he has to deal with growing old and time passing him by. Or if you take my okay. interpretation that I don't agree with, he wimped out on that moment, and that's why he's having a hard time dealing with himself in retirement. On rewatch, I noticed the reason Aquaman was dead. We talked about this, the fact that you're paying Cartel attention, back, you see yeah. how the crime scene has changed. So that explains almost everything, so, except for I'm still not sure how they tracked Moss to Del Rio. It's a good drive from Terrell County, but is the closest major border crossing. Perhaps they corrected guest he would go there. How they track? So I thought
the transponder was still in the back.
The Mexicans, the reason Sugar killed Stephen Root is because he was incensed that he didn't trust him to do the job. Although,
okay, sure.
I don't get Sugar's game here at all, because he kills the guys that he's working for. Like, he just seems like he's, I don't know yeah. what he's doing.
He's gone rogue is what Stephen Root says, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. But he'd given the transponder to the Mexican cartel as well, and the more people looking, right. the better. So that's how...
Sure, to the cartel, to just, Wells, just, to everybody.
And
yeah.
he's essentially doing the same thing Sugar's doing, which is driving around until you get a little ping on it.
Right.
So, did hiding stuff in ducks become a trope before or after this? This could be based on the order I've watched movies and shows in, but I feel like this could have started it. I don't know, man. Fucking around in Vince has been a trope for, like, ever. Like, James Bond does it. Mission Impossible does it. Like, hiding right. stuff in Vince. I'm trying to think what other instances I've seen this, but I don't know. I'm not equipped to answer this question. To the extent okay. that it's a trope, and whether this, I mean, no way a movie that came out in 2007 started anything.
Sure, sure.
You know, as far as this, like, yeah, you can say the Matrix started the, you know, time stop, wire foo shit, fine. Yeah. But as far as, like, hiding things in Vince or things like that, I don't know about that. Gary Turco says, Tommy Lee Jones' character says he makes a pot of coffee about once a week. As a lover of coffee, I found this to be gross and a bit odd. Coffee's cheap. Not sure why the writers included this bit of small talk. This is kind of a joking email, but what, you're the coffee guy. Now, when he says I make a pot of coffee about once a week, was he saying that he drinks week old coffee? Or was he saying I make about, that's about as much as I drink? Like, I, you know, I make a pot every once in a while.
No, I think he actually, like, so coffee, when you get, like, you know, okay, barring any kind of fancy thermos contraption, when you get about 4 hours out on a freshly brewed pot of coffee that's just sitting there to cool, it doesn't change much after that.
Yeah.
It's about as bitter as it's ever going
to
be.
So it gets to its maximum level of shit, and then...
Yeah. And eventually it'll go bad, but it takes a while.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't be, like, mortally scared to drink a week-old pot of coffee if it didn't have anything floating in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not going to taste any worse than it did 8 hours after you brewed it.
Okay.
So I could see this guy making a pot of coffee once
a week.
And I
feel like this is to sell this Texas character. Like, he doesn't really care about creature comforts.
No. And you can, I mean, look at his house. Mm-hmm. Come on.
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with his house?
It's just a shithole. It's cluttered. You didn't see everything? Just all horribly dirty, cats jumping everywhere. Like, yeah, his place is absolute
that's
festering
his uncle's
shithole.
House. That's his uncle's house with all the cats.
He's the one that brewed the coffee once a week.
Oh, yeah, he's saying, like, Tommy Lee Jones' character. So he just gave me bad information.
Right, no, it's okay. His uncle who says, I brew it once a week and I throw it out.
Okay.
Whatever's left over.
Okay, gotcha. You know, this is a weird cat guy, so what, you know, what do you do?
Maybe he brews it for his cats. I don't know. Maybe that's why they're jumping all over
want
the place.
Caffeinated cats, man.
I don't, but maybe he does. You know, he's out there, he's lonely, he wants some entertainment.
Steven says, I'd like your thoughts on Javier Bardem's lock shooting air gun. Also, would you take the money? I feel like we've talked about the captive bolt gun enough.
Yep.
It's a great, like, I remember one of the elders at our hall was somewhat notorious for watching rated R films. Like, is yeah, Larry. Okay. Not yeah. The
I thought you were going to go the Russ route here.
No.
Okay.
And this film, like, really gave him the heebie-jeebies. He confided to me that he'd watched it. He's like, he wanted to know if I had, because he knows that I was kind of sly about watching them every once in a while.
So he could bust you.
And he was just, particularly, it's like this captive bolt gun. He's like, there was something so cold and menacing, like it really gave him chills.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, he's slaughtering people, literally slaughtering people like cattle, because this is something they actually use on ranches.
And it's
to
something
slaughter
that you're
cattle.
Not, like, I, if someone came up to me with that, I wouldn't feel immediately threatened. And by the time, like, he got up against your head, it's all over. Like, I guess that's what's the really scary thing about it.
You don't recognize it as a weapon, necessarily.
No, it's like, what is this? You're going to test my breath for alcohol? And you're dead. By the time you're still grappling with what the fuck is going on, you're already dead. And that's a bit chilling.
Here's the other thing that I found out in my reading about this captive bolt rifle or pistol thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it is used on ranches to kill cattle.
Right.
For slaughtering, to get their meat. It doesn't... So it's meant to stun them, actually. So it doesn't damage the brain stem.
Really?
Like, that's why they do it, because it destroys a part of the brain that stuns them, and so their heart keeps beating, so when they bleed them, they can get all the blood out more easily.
Okay.
So, not super humane,
well,
you know, as far as slaughtering cattle goes, but, convenient for getting the blood out, I guess.
Okay.
Which is why they do it. So it's extra creepy in that regard, in that it's not actually meant to kill for its intended purpose. It's meant to stun.
But the cow would not recover, right?
No.
Okay,
It destroys that part of the brain. All
right, gotcha. Let's see. And we both agreed we'd take the money. So,
yeah.
Connor B. said, the novel this film was based on got its title from the poem Sailing to Byzantium by William Butler Yeats. In it, the narrator states that this is no country for old men, and that therefore he is sailing to Byzantium to try and become a part of something that is eternal. Hmm. This relates to one viewing of the film that takes all three of the main characters and their ideologies and deconstructs them. Their codes of conduct and behaviors are proven to not be correct by the end of the story. In this, they are all in search of something that will make them ideologically eternal. Anton has his moral code, the strange principles that Carson notes that he has. These principles are broken by Carla Jean when she states that only Anton can change her fate and not a coin. All throughout the film, we see Anton making decisions based on this code, and after he sees that it's broken, he decides to walk away from it all, I think, in search of something new. So he's got the jewels. going to go walk the earth kind of theory, too.
Fair enough.
Llewellyn has his money. To him, Anton is a hunter who's playing a game with him to get his satchel of cash. When he threatens Carla Jean, it bothers him so much that his story is no longer about money, but of defeating the boogeyman who's threatening his family. And this Llewellyn switches his ideology to be something that he believes will save him and his family from death. However, he's so blinded by this that he's caught off guard by the Mexican hitmen that do eventually kill him. Finally, Ed Tom Bell has his idea of old-fashioned justice. However, he finds his idea of justice does not work anymore when there are serial killer couples in California and Anton Sugar terrorizing West Texas. He ultimately walks away from all of it, realizing that the area is just not ultra-violent now, but has always been, and his methods just simply can't defeat the seemingly random form of evil. He's now looking for meaning in his dreams, in search of a new meaning in life. A question I have for you two is, what did you make of Bell's dreams? First of all, I appreciate your analysis there, and it does seem like, Connor, we got around to the dreams. Like, I felt like the whole idea of the money was just to let you know that the money part of the film wasn't important, and the really important part is the meditation on fate and mortality.
Right. But honestly, I feel like, in a lot of ways, Tommy Lee Jones is the ideal sheriff, the ideal law enforcement officer, honestly. In that sort of Andy Griffith kind of way.
Right.
Where he's not out to necessarily just enforce the law, he's out to help people. And whether that means ignoring certain things about the letter of the law in order to, he doesn't write the guy up for having an improperly secured load on his truck or whatever. He just says, hey, man, be more careful.
That was a weird scene, too, we didn't talk about.
Yeah, I think it's just establishing.
Well, you know what? I thought it was a red herring because when I first saw that, oh, shit, there's a truckload of corpses going by.
Or and drugs or something.
And you find out that it's just that's the coroner. He's using a fucking tow truck or something.
Right. And ultimately, like, the letter isn't as important as the spirit and just, like, the spirit of law enforcement.
I do think.
Shouldn't be letter of the law necessarily.
Yeah, I do think. I hope you're not suggesting that he wouldn't take Llewellyn to jail if he caught him. Because, like, he was doing that whole, like, I just want to help your husband. I mean, that's age-old cop logic. Like,
I'm actually not certain that he would have, because what had Llewellyn done wrong at that point? He took money that he found in the desert.
I think that's probably illegal. That's probably a crime. Like, you find drug money and dead people in the desert, and you not only not report it, but you abscond on it with yourself.
Right, but what's
you're
more...
You're an accessory.
What's more important? Like, has he learned his lesson? He's got a fucking hunter coming after him trying to kill him. I think Llewellyn has learned the lesson. What good does it do to take this man to prison afterward?
I mean, that's a fair question. I just don't know that Tommy Lee Jones is that enlightened. I don't know.
Okay, I thought he was. Maybe I'm giving him too much credit.
No, I think your point's entirely fair. Okay. What you're suggesting is definitely there to be interpreted. I just saw it more as him telling the wife that you know I don't want your husband.
Right,
I want the
right.
bad guys. I'm just trying to protect them. Like that's what they all say.
Sure.
Anyway, what else? That's it. That's all the feedback we got.
Okay.
Once again, I want to give shouts out to Keith Alejandro, Jin, Alex M., Matt DeReamer, Steven, My Dear Deadly, Andy G., Jefferson B., Coco, 2MC, 2MC for me, Gary, Turco, Jasmine P., Andrew K., Connor B., Martin K., and Jeffrey Bowser. Thank you very much for pitching together and commissioning this community podcast. We'll be back next week with another one. If you'd like to find out how you can commission your own podcast, go to baldmove.com/shop and click on the big film canister, and you will quickly determine how all that stuff works.
Yeah, I think next one up might be Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which should be interesting.
Ah, yes.
Since neither of us have seen it.
Return to the Hellmouth.
And, and it's a TV show.
I've seen the first season.
I have too. Yeah.
Okay, in its entirety. So and
none of the episodes we're reviewing are from the first season.
Right.
So.
But I also think it's from the pre-golden, dawn of the golden age. So it's a little bit more procedural. It's like kind of like if you've seen the first two seasons of Star Trek, you could probably hang with season 4 or 5.
Yeah.
I'm hoping, because after the Lost fiasco where, multiple people were kind of unhappy with how we covered that, we reached out to all the people that had outstanding TV show orders and being like, you should reconsider. because clearly we can't guarantee any kind of product quality if we haven't seen the whole work and blah blah blah.
Yeah,
but
both
of the people they're intrepid. They want to hear our opinions, good, bad, ill advised, ill informed, whatever. And that's the end of the day.
But if Buffy has been assimilated by the Borg and unassimilated, I need to know that going in.
That's the thing. I feel like that's the charm of the Commission podcast is you pay your money for what you're passionate about and you want to hear our honest opinions on it.
Right.
So hopefully that'll track clean. But yeah, baldmove.com/shop if you want to see what your Community Commission options are. Which I need to refresh that. I've got a whole bunch of, like, I got like a half a dozen that people have requested that I think would be good. And I've got a couple that I'd like to put in as like an Aaron select, too.
Yeah.
But that'll be changing probably before the end of the month. Baldmove.com/shop if you want to see those options. And we will see you next time.
See ya.